Welcome to City Club of Eugene, April 19th, 2019 program. Congressman Peter DeFazio, report from Washington, D.C., transportation and infrastructure. This is the 29th program, or 2018-2019 programming year. I'm Joel Corin, president of City Club. This program was coordinated by Jess Guieri. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors. Our diamond sponsors, our Kaiser Permanente, exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. University of Oregon. Since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health. Our mission and shared purpose since we were founded more than 125 years ago is to promote personal and community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, and to treat each person in a loving and caring way. For more, visit peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor today, Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton, the law offices of Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton, whose mission is to obtain justice and compensation, just compensation, for people who have been harmed because of someone else's wrongful conduct. More information at justicelawyers.com. Our speaker today is Congressman Pete DeFazio. As you know, it was another dull week in Washington. Congressman DeFazio was first elected to Congress in 1986. He will share his thoughts on the need to invest in our nation's crumbling infrastructure and make it more resilient to climate change, while also reducing the impact of transportation and the environment. DeFazio has served as a member of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure since he first entered Congress. In 2019, he was elected to chair the committee, which is comprised of six subcommittees: aviation, Coast Guard, maritime, economic development and public buildings and emergency management, highways and transit, railroads, pipelines, hazardous materials, and six, water resources and the environment. During his time on the committee, he has chaired or served as ranking member of four of the six subcommittees: aviation, Coast Guard and maritime transportation, highways and transit, water resources and the environment. And Pete shares another distinction. He's one of only three Democrats in Washington not running for president. Congressman DeFazio.
Well, I haven't done a formal announcement that I'm not running yet, which I guess you're supposed to do. Well, thanks. It's great to be home for the Easter break. I just was meeting with Mayor Venice, and we're talking about two conferences she's going to in Hawaii. And one is on climate as it relates to cities and plans for moving forward in sustainable ways. And the second is on transportation, and actually they intersect, and we had a lot of good conversation about that. On Monday I'm doing a presentation with Dr. Bill Ripple from Oregon State University. And he wrote the second warning to humanity, or organized and wrote the second warning to humanity on climate change. And he's going to do a presentation of how bad things are, and then I'm supposed to follow him and talk about how we're going to fix it. It should be interesting. It's at 7 o'clock, so a lot of people may not listen to this broadcast if they go there, but I'm pleased to be invited here today. I'm going to talk about transportation and other things under my jurisdiction that I'm working on, and then link it a little bit to the subject of climate change. I am working on a long-term surface transportation bill for the country. We haven't raised the federal gas tax since 1993. We have 47,000 bridges on the national highway system. They're structurally deficient. We have another 235,000 that need work. 40% of the roadbed is deteriorated to the point we have to totally rebuild it, not just resurface it. And for transit, we have a $100 billion backlog to bring transit up to a state of good repair in this country, let alone begin to build out new transit options for people to help them get out of their vehicles. And all of these things contribute to, you know, how are we going to move forward sustainably. We need to do those things and bring the system up to a state of good repair, no matter what fuel vehicles are using in the future. If they're electric trucks or they're hydrogen fuel cell trucks or cars, we're going to still need a national network. So we need safe bridges, we need good road surface, and we need better transit. People in cities, in D.C., the ridership for Metro has fallen off because it got so bad they were killing people, and it was so undependable. People said, hey, I got to get to work on time. I can't get on the Metro in Silver Spring, and then we get to Tacoma Park, it breaks down, and you put me on a bus, and I'm an hour late to work. So people started going back to their cars. So bringing up transit up to a state of good repair is going to be helpful, but then we have to talk about new options and how are we, you know, how are we going to do that in the future. Portland Metro is, I think, probably leading the way on electric buses, or at least has the most, one of the most innovative approaches. LA is doing the same thing. I was in Orange County. They're doing electric buses, and that is one route. We may go to hydrogen fuel cells in the future, but one way or another, we're going to defossilize mass transit. So let me just talk about how we're going to get there. We need more federal investment, and this is the problem. My leadership doesn't want to lead on more investment, and the administration doesn't want to lead on more investment. In the short term, really the only way we're going to be able to deal with the trust fund and deal with these issues, the American Society of Civil Engineers says we're about $1 trillion short over 10 years to bring the system up to a state of good repair and help mitigate congestion. So the federal government has not raised the fuel tax since 93. Many states, including Oregon, have. Oregon's done it, I think, two or three times since 93, as have other states, including states that are all red. They realize the value of doing this. So it's a, you know, this kind of approach. I propose something I think is de minimis, which is just index the gas and diesel tax, which we should have done in 93, and we wouldn't be in this hole. And then begin bonding with the increment of what that would produce in terms of future income. We could bond over 10 years, $500 billion, which would help with two things. One is we're currently, every year, $17 billion a year short on the Highway Trust Fund. The Republicans, when they passed the last bill, the FAST Act, pretended that we funded it, but we didn't. So we're borrowing $17 billion a year to put in the Highway Trust Fund. Now, I can justify that because a lot of the things we're doing with the Highway Trust Fund, building a bridge or something else, you're talking about 100 years. If we had capital budgets, this would all make sense. We don't have capital budgets. So there's pressures with things called PAYGO and all that. We might actually fall off a cliff in 2020 and see transportation investment reduced. So I propose the, what I call a penny for progress. There are other proposals out there. Even the United States Chamber of Commerce is proposing 25-cent gas tax increase, 5-5-5-5-5. The problem with that is the first 2 years we would have to reduce spending. The third year you catch up, and by the fifth year they would get to where I would get to in the first year with bonding and indexing the gas and diesel tax. So I'm trying to push both my leadership, and I'm trying to deal with the White House. I was in a meeting with President Trump a year ago where he said he could do a quarter, but we've seen nothing out of them except proposals to cut investment and to privatize and toll the whole existing network, which even with him is a non-starter. So I've been assigned a new liaison who I'm working with, and that would be Ivanka. And you know, she's got the president's ear. So we'll see. But like I say, my leadership doesn't want to step off and say, well, if we do revenue and he doesn't, they'll attack us. And so it's a bit frustrating. But in terms of rebuilding the system, we have to rebuild it in a way that does numerous things. We have to rebuild it resistant to severe climate events. It has to be adaptive. It should have less impact on the environment. You're talking about bioswales. You're talking about new ways of manufacturing road service that are less carbon intense in the manufacturer, or even carbon absorbing in terms of some innovative new substances we could use. We've got to look to those things. We have to build in an electric backbone. I don't know whether we're going to go with hydrogen fuel cells or electric or both. In the last bill, I got in provisions that said each state has to plan a minimum of one north-south, one east-west electrification route for the future. But we didn't put any money behind it. They supposedly have all submitted their plans. I haven't checked to see if all 50 states have. But we've got to put money behind it, help them, and give them incentives and push forward the electrification. I've seen the Tesla electric truck. It's incredible. It's still a little limited in terms of range, but we're headed there. Hydrogen fuel cells also have promise. But in both cases, whether you're talking hydrogen fuel cells or you're talking electrification, we need sustainable ways of creating the electricity to get there. One thing would be to use hydropower and wind power when they're in surplus to crack water, produce hydrogen. That's one possible path. But the point is, we've got to be ready to accommodate that. The hydrogen can be done with existing fueling stations, but the electrification we need to, that's a new thing we need to build in. In terms of transit, we've got to look at moving to electric buses. Some people are, again, maybe hydrogen fuel cells. A lot of people have gone to natural gas, but we've got to evolve beyond that. So we need to have a federal program to do that. So there's a lot we can do. That's just surface transportation. Also within my jurisdiction is wastewater. We haven't reauthorized the Clean Water State Revolving Fund since 1987. The federal government used to be a great partner with communities on wastewater. When we built MWMC, I was a commissioner. We got a 75% federal match. If we were building the system today, we would get a zero federal match. I've had promising conversations with Senator Wicker as jurisdiction over that in the Senate, a very conservative guy from Alabama, but he recognizes the need and is very interested in working with me on that. And then through a series of hearings I've been holding, when the Republicans were in charge, we were kind of locked in amber as deals with climate change or the future transportation or livability. They hate all those words. So one of my first hearings was on sustainable transportation and sustainability in terms of everything under my jurisdiction. I've directed every subcommittee to hold hearings on sustainability. So in wastewater, I went to a hearing, and we had a wastewater authority from New Jersey who came in. I'd never heard of this before, but this is great. They rebuilt their system. They did get an SRF loan, 0.75% loan over 30 years. So they said, we didn't even need to raise rates, and we rebuilt our system. And we put in a methane capture system, and we are generating our own electricity, and we generate more than we need, and we're putting it on the grid. And I said, wow, I never heard of that. And the staff says, oh, well, it's just a pilot program under appropriations. I said, no, we're going to make that a fully authorized permanent program, and I'm actually going to mandate that all rebuilding include methane capture. I mean, sure, it's a small part of the problem, but it's a part of the problem. You're creating sustainable electricity. You're avoiding methane, which is 80 times more powerful than CO2 in terms of climate change into the atmosphere. So that's good. Also, under my jurisdiction are pipelines. We have to rewrite the Pipeline Safety Authorization Act this year. I don't get to control what goes through the pipelines. That's the Energy and Commerce Committee. But I get to regulate the safety of the pipelines. And an article this last year in New York Times said that even though we have estimates that, the new estimates coming out of Harvard and another group are that we're leaking about 3 to 5% of raw gas, which is mostly methane, out of the existing pipelines. So that's a phenomenal contribution to climate change. Even in Eugene's having a debate over natural gas, not natural gas, or how would we deal with this. But first thing we ought to do is a no-brainer, make them safe, and secondly, make them so they don't leak, so that we don't have wasteful and unnecessary contribution to climate change. So I'll be taking on that. Federal government, I think, is probably the largest occupancy of of real estate in the country in terms, and the General Services Administration is under my authority. which administers the program to either lease or build federal buildings. And I said, well, we got to work. I was meeting with a friend of mine as an architect, and I said, well, I'm going to mandate they all meet platinum standard. He said, no, there's something beyond platinum. And I said, what's beyond platinum? It's an architect named Ed Mazzaria, who has what's called the 2030 plan, which is buildings should be self-sustaining. And it's totally feasible and not that much more expensive than a platinum building. And so I want to mandate that GSA in the future, anything we lease or we build is going to be self-sustaining. And in fact, in certain areas of the country, particularly desert areas, they can contribute back onto the grid again with electricity. So that I'm going to work with on GSA. When you start after that, getting marine transportation is already the most efficient way to move freight. But our inland waterway system is collapsing. We're operating locks that are 100 years old and they're at the point of failure. And if they fail, then you're going to see, you know, many, many more trucks on the road. We've got to invest in the inland waterway system. We've got to invest in our harbors around the outside of the country because maritime transport is the most fuel efficient way to move goods and people. We have been assessing a tax since the Reagan years, before I was in Congress, for harbor maintenance. For years, Congress has been diverting that tax in part. So we have a theoretical balance of $10 billion, which could go into rebuilding our harbors and jetties and take pressure off the Corps there, and then the Corps could afford to put more money into rebuilding the locks for the inland waterway system. Twice I got out of committee a proposal to spend, this is radical in Washington, D.C., the harbor maintenance tax on harbor maintenance. And and the first time I offered it, the chairman was just shocked because the Freedom Caucus was voting with me. The Republicans were in charge. He said, you got a unanimous vote. And I said, yeah, Bill, people, you know, they believe in, if we have a dedicated tax, it should be spent for that purpose. And so he was great, but then when we went to go to the floor of the House, Speaker Paul Ryan had it pulled out of the bill. And that happened two Congresses in a row, because Paul did not believe in federal investment in infrastructure. This year, Paul Ryan isn't there, and the Speaker I have will not pull my amendment out of the bill, and we will begin to spend down the backlog on harbor maintenance on dealing with these very real needs to encourage even more maritime transport. You get to aviation, that's probably the toughest thing. There's a lot of needs in aviation. One thing, part of my infrastructure package is to allow airports to assess something called a passenger facility charge. Many years ago, when I was first in Congress, Eugene had to build a new airport. They built a new airport. All the costs went to the taxpayers of Eugene in terms of a property tax assessment to repay the bonds. And I said, well, everyone doesn't seem too fair to me. I live in Springfield, and I use the airport, I'm sure, more than 99 9/10% of the people in Eugene. So I actually created a program back then called, or recreated it. We'd had one. It had been done away with because of abuses. And we brought it back in a way that isn't abused. It's a passenger facility charge. And an airport is allowed to assess a fee on people who pass through for things that benefit only the traveling public. When the program was done away with before, cities were diverting the money into general fund and other things. So we put parameters around it. It can only benefit the passengers going through the airport. Our airports have huge unmet needs. People sit on the tarmac waiting to get to a gate. The plane just sitting there idling. Our security areas need to be reconfigured with the post 9/11 threats. Many of them were built, back in the 60s and 70s. So I'm proposing to assess an additional passenger facility charge, which takes care of that. In terms of aviation, which is right now a relatively small contributor to climate change, it's continuing to grow very quickly. So we've got to look for solutions there too. And the most promising thing is what's called an electro-biofuel, which is a much more intensive biofuel. It requires much less land mass to grow the inputs for that. But again, you need sustainable electricity to produce it. But actually, electro-biofuels can produce a substitute for Jet A that would work with existing airplanes. So that's one potential way to go there. So there are other things I have to do. I've got to reauthorize National Transportation Safety Board, who's obviously very involved in the 737 MAX issue, which my committee is also involved in a very deep investigation there. I actually now have an investigative staff And we have put out a series of questions and requests for documents to Boeing, FAA, the European authorities, and the Brazilians, because an interesting thing is when everybody was reviewing this plane, the Europeans originally said, well, you're going to have to retrain the pilots. And the Brazilians said, you're going to have to retrain the pilots. This is a new plane. And ultimately, the Europeans relented and said, no, you don't have to retrain the pilots. The Brazilians never did. And I want to see the correspondence and how that came about. Was it pressure from FAA, or how did this whole thing? There's a lot of very complicated issues around the 737, which I'm not going to go into. But bottom line, is that we're delving into that too. I've got to reauthorize the United States Coast Guard. We did a reauthorization quite quickly in the last Congress, and then the Senate took so long that we ended up with a one-year bill instead of a two-year bill. So we've got to move a Coast Guard authorization. So that's a few of the things I'm working on. I obviously continue to work on things beyond the purview of my committee. I've proposed a way to make Social Security sustainable into the future. Bernie and I have been trying to do this for years, lift the cap and have people pay on all their income. And we could actually increase benefits for the very elderly. We could have a real cost of living adjustment for seniors, as opposed to one that doesn't really cover their living cost increases. I've put that forward. And then I'm still working on other issues like war powers. We shouldn't get involved in foreign entanglements without a president presenting a plan to the United States Congress under the War Powers Act. As to what the objectives are and how we're going to get out of these involvements, and so I'm working on that and a few other things. Let me see how long I took. I hate this timer because of the security things on my phone. Anyway, that's probably long enough. I would rather spend more time on questions. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up and come up with some great questions. Appreciate it.
Okay, we will now take a break for 5 minutes for folks to work on their questions. Everyone can contribute to the discussion at the table. Only City Club members can ask questions, but if you're a non-member, if you have a question, talk to a City Club member and they may ask it for you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the April 19th, 2019 program. Congressman Peter DeFazio, report from Washington on transportation and infrastructure. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our gold sponsors, Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union, Emergency Veterinary Hospital Network Charter School, Arriving by Bike, and Dr. Sandy Yabaro. Special thanks both to KRVM Radio, Dot Dotson Photography, Pack Info and Simplified Computing LLC, and special thanks also to KLCC that broadcasts our City Club programs on Monday night at 6:30, and thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29 for televising recent City Club programs. We're now going to start the questioning. I'd like to remind folks that here at City Club, we value and respect all opinions, questions, and points of view, and treat speakers with respect. I'd also like to remind you of the 1 minute time limit so that you avoid the bell of shame. Oh, you right up front.
Okay.
Guess we can't start without you, so. Randy?
Thank you for coming, Congressman DeFazio. I'm Randy Prince, the City Club member. Question about infrastructure and climate change. For about 14 years, a couple of Canadian companies have been seeking to build a 200 and some mile pipeline to carry natural gas, originally from the Rockies, all the way to Coos Bay. It leaves quite a scar on the landscape. There's a huge amount of dredging that's going to go on. Some of that fill will be piled up to support the terminal, which is built on sandy ground. Disruption to the ecology. And then there's questions about whether it's economically viable with this natural gas supply. Now, of course, Coos Bay is hungry for jobs, and they are saying there might be 75 or 100 jobs. The community split. Maybe they're even in support of it. But would you be willing to go against what might be a majority of people who favor this project and speak out against building more fossil fuel infrastructure at this time and place?
Thanks for the question. I understand. I'm glad to help with marketing here. I understand some people just signed up for City Club so they could ask questions. So you don't usually have to do that. You know, I hold town meetings, but in any case, happy to take the questions. I wasn't going to. This won't come out until Monday night, so I can announce it now because I was going to announce it Monday night when I'm doing the event with Bill Ripple. But the reason that Jordan Cove can go forward are two things. Energy Facility Siting Council in Oregon lost the authority over siting major energy facilities. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is responsive only to the President of the United States, not to the United States Congress, the way it was created, was given the right to grant eminent domain to energy companies for pipelines and high tension lines and other things. I vigorously opposed that legislation. It's called the Bush-Cheney Energy Act. Ed Markey and I tried to amend those things out. We didn't succeed. And I've introduced legislation in the past, and I've introduced it again, and perhaps what is a more favorable Congress, to take away the authority of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to grant as someone who's going to export natural gas eminent domain to site a pipeline and to reinstate the authority of states to control energy facility siting councils. In terms of FERC, they don't care what I think. I petitioned them twice to use a less destructive route for the pipeline called the Blue Ridge, which would have impacted fewer private properties and hit less critical habitat on federal lands, and they just said, bye-bye. So I'm doing what I can legislatively. They don't care what my opinion is. They are responsive, appointed by and responsive to the president, and we know what his position is on these issues.
Betty Taylor, City Club member since 1990. And I hope you stay in Congress forever. You're doing a good job.
Betty, no.
But there's something, you didn't mention Amtrak. Oh. I recently took a long train ride. We were delayed about 6 hours, I think, by a broken rail. And I noticed also that things inside the train need repairs. And one crew member said to me, we always get left out. She said she'd been working for Amtrak for 20 years. We always get left out. It is related to climate change and transportation. And I wonder if you're going to push for more funding for Amtrak.
Sure. I'm sorry. I forgot one of my subcommittees when I was mentioning subcommittees, which is rail. Yes. I mean, rail is the second most efficient way to move freight after water. And rail is way more efficient in terms of moving people than other modes of transportation. So, in the last long-term service transportation bill, we managed to hold the line for Amtrak. We have Republicans who are always trying to kill it, but we didn't manage to get them a substantial increase in their budget. The new head of Amtrak is very innovative. He's trying to drag them into the 20th century, not the 21st. That's too much of a shock. And he is doing some very interesting things. And I've met with him a couple of times. And, you know, one of the first six designated high-speed railroads in the country was from Eugene to Vancouver, BC. And that was done by myself and a guy named Al Swift, who was from Washington State. Oregon has done nothing with it, or virtually nothing. We've done a little connect to Oregon to help, you know, get some sidings and that. Washington State has a comprehensive plan. They put a lot of investment into it. And so Oregon is at the point of now, only 25 years after the law was passed, of coming up with a higher speed route. They're really close. I keep hearing that. They have like one person who does rail for the state. So the state needs to put more emphasis there, but I intend to put more money into Amtrak. They need to repower all of their long-distance trains, and they can be repowered in a way that's much more efficient than the current trains they're using. And then you won't have the breakdowns. But the other thing we have to deal with is the freight. And between here and Portland, the reason why it's not reliable for the absent a breakdown is freight. And we passed a law a number of years ago that said the freight companies had to give precedence to Amtrak. They went to court, and Amtrak lost. It's a very complicated decision, and I won't go into specifics of it. But we need to reinstate that authority in a way that the court can't overturn so that they get preference over freight, because we're operating mostly on freight lines. Only on the East Coast is the federal government owned right away, gave it all away in the 1800s to rail companies. So if we can reinstate that authority and get them new power and trains, we will have a much better system. And the other thing that that Richard Anderson, the head of Amtrak, is doing in the interim, which is really good, is he's actually working with the freight railroads. Now, BNSF you can work with. UP is very difficult. There's Senator Wicker, who I mentioned earlier, who has jurisdiction over rail in the Senate from Alabama, wanted an improvement in a line called the Crescent Line down south in terms of reliability on time performance. And so Richard Anderson went to CSX and said, how about this? They said, $1 billion. It cost you $1 billion. Because you'd have to double track all this and do that if you want to get those kind of performance times. So Richard said, well, can I just look at your data, your schedules, and all that? And so CSX, not being as difficult as UP, said, okay, they gave it to him. And he put a team of people on it, and they analyzed it, and they came up with three critical points. And so they're going to be able to, for $84 million, not $1 billion, get the on-time performance they want. So I said, that's great, I love it. How about analyzing the route from Eugene to Portland? And so he has put people on that now. I said, if you can get me there reliably in 2 hours, I will never get on I-5 again. I mean, the last time I came down on Saturday, it was like 2 hours, 45 minutes because of a car fire just north of Corvallis. So I'd be happy to get off I-5, but I can't, you know, be going to Portland for appointments or whatever, and it's gonna take between 2 hours and 40 minutes and 3.5 hours to get there. He's working on that. So those are things. They need more funding, they need new power, they need to yet again get precedence over freight, and then we'll have a better system.
Steve?
Hi, Steve Robinson. I'm with Cascadia Prepared, and I was interested in your update on the transportation system and all of the thousands of bridges nationwide that are in vulnerable condition. You know what I'm going to talk about, right? Obviously, thousands of bridges in Oregon that are likely to fail all at the same time when we have our Cascadia quake. And so I'm wondering what your advice is to the people of Oregon and the Oregon legislature in terms of waiting for the feds to come and help with money to fix our broken transportation system, or whether we should kind of go ahead and try to be aggressive about that ourselves.
Well, I don't follow in total detail ODOT, and ODOT's about to get a new director for the first time in many years, who I think will be much better, more innovative, more transparent than what we've had. But my understanding is the legislature was that they did have a program to begin rebuild bridges in Oregon for earthquake. A little bit, but they have a program. They did get, you know, a substantial transportation bill in the passed in the last legislature. I don't know how much of that they're applying. So obviously, yeah, pressure on them will be helpful. But the feds have to come back in as partners. And so my definition of resilience, building something that's more resilient, is not just climate change. It's also other catastrophic events, which would be earthquakes. And I did manage to pass a bill through the House already. It's sitting in the Senate to have FEMA come up with a plan to deploy an early warning system in the deep ocean near where we believe the earthquake event is going to happen, which could save a lot of lives in the future. So, I'm working on that. And during the Clinton years, FEMA actually had a quite well-funded program for cities, and Seattle did a lot with this before they had another quake, to build resilience into their infrastructure and their buildings. And I think FEMA should get back into that business of partnering with the states and the cities in terms of building in resilience for what is a predictable, we don't know when, catastrophe. So I'm with you. Thanks.
Jerry?
Representative DeFazio, you know more about Social Security than anybody else in Congress. SSI was set up to replace welfare for people with disabilities. Why is it years behind, leaving abandoned, disabled people flooding communities with homeless persons?
Well, Social Security is funded out of FICA taxes, and the issue with Social Security is that it's predicted in, I think, the latest trustees report was 2038, the trust fund will be depleted and benefits would drop to about 75% of what were promised. There's a few ways to fix it. One is raise the tax. One is to increase the retirement age again. I don't support those two except in a limited way. The third one, which is raise the tax in terms of lifting the cap so that all income is taxed for Social Security, which gives us, you know, at predictability as far as the actuaries will go, because we don't know future birth rates and death rates and all that. But 70 years out, we could have, as I mentioned earlier, a better cost of living for people on Social Security. We could increase benefits for people who get very elderly because most everybody outlives their savings. And then, so that's Social Security. SSI is funded out of the general fund of the United States, and it's a partnership with the states. Oregon has one of the lowest state matches in the country for SSI income. And so that's why you have the problem here. Other states put up a much more robust match. There's a certain amount of federal money that goes to every SSI recipient, but it's up to the state to match that. They have to do some match, or they, you know, but they, there's no requirement that they give a match that would take that person up to a reasonable level of income for basic living needs, and that's an issue with the state legislature, but obviously they also have revenue issues. So I don't know whether they're looking at that or not. There's at least one state representative here who might be able to answer that.
My concern was that the application is taking years for already dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, that has been an ongoing issue for SSI, SSDI. It's actually a state agency that evaluates those things. Social Security has a contract with them. When I used to work for Jim Weaver, I dealt with that agency. I wrote a master's project on the problems with Social Security disability determination, which also went to disability determination for SSI. Things have gotten worse. Part of the problem is the Republicans have limited the amount of trust fund money we can use to administer Social Security, which is why you can't get anybody to answer the phone, and why we don't have enough appeals judges for people to get a reasonably short court date. And my staff spends a lot of time on these issues trying to help expedite petitions for people and appeals for people who are deserving but have been left out either for SSDI or SSI in terms of disability determination. Simply, we should be spending more money to have more administrative law judges and move the process a lot more quickly.
Jack?
Well, Peter, I hate to burden you any further, but this climate change issue, I want to revisit Betty's comment and your response. You know, this is a catastrophe that's in the near future. It's inevitable. Every intelligent person on the planet knows it. And fixing roads and bridges is not going to get it done. We have to have, as a centerpiece, a high-speed rail network nationwide to relieve trucking and air travel as a huge sources of pollution. You know, Western Europe has it, China has it, Japan has it. China now has 17,000 miles of high-speed rail with trains that go 200 miles an hour that are used by 30% of their proper population. 30% of their population is the entire American population. So, how do we pay for it? You pay for it from the Pentagon budget.
Please ask your question.
Okay, I'm getting to it. This is important, Joel. This is important, okay?
You pay for it.
He asks questions. How do you pay for it? That's always
Thank
the
you.
Question. You pay for it out of the Pentagon budget.
Can the
because we don't need all
question?
The... Okay, let me finish. because we don't need, you know, these constant wars. They're not just foreign entanglements. They're terrible. They're wars.
Thank you.
Okay. Secondly,
no.
There's two sources of energy. You said, where do you get the energy? You get the,
one question, please, for 1 minute. Congressman, please answer the question.
Well, we didn't quite get to the question, but I can address it. I mentioned earlier war powers. It's been something I've been championing for years, that before the president deploys forces overseas, that they have to have the authority from Congress. That's in the Constitution. That would limit some of these foreign adventures that we've gotten involved in. But beyond that, yeah, I'm all for cutting the Pentagon budget. I've been trying to audit the Pentagon for more than a decade. I once got an amendment passed at about 3 o'clock in the morning because the chairman of the Appropriations Committee was a little tired and his staff wasn't paying a lot of attention. And I partnered with a guy from New Jersey named Frelinghausen, and we got an amendment to require an audit of the Pentagon. We audit every agency of the federal government every year. The Pentagon has never been audited. They are determined to be unauditable, so we got that. Unfortunately, we got it in the bill, but they stripped it out in the conference committee. So you know, we know there's massive waste, and we've got to get to the bottom of that. We have a new chairman of the committee who wants to cut back on their overseas contingency operations slush fund and make other meaningful reductions in the DOD budget. But to go to your first premise, and I said this during my opening remarks, we have to rebuild the national highway system. Because there is not enough rail capacity in this country today, and there might be more in the future, but to move freight and people. And if they're using electric trucks or they're using hydrogen fuel trucks or today fossil fuel trucks, we need to rebuild those 47,000 bridges. And building high-speed rail is no simple prospect. The Chinese have done it very well. They have a different rule, which is, I just knocked on your door, you have 2 days, get out of your house. The bulldozers are coming. We're building a right-of-way for a rail line. As you see what happened in California, they're having a lot of trouble building a greenfield that is a new rail line through people's property. People don't want it individually. They want it in aggregate. They say, oh, I would love to have high-speed rail. Oh, would you mind if it goes through your property? Yeah, I'd really mind. I don't want a railroad going through my property. So it's not an easy thing. You know, we could, but it won't happen. We could socialize the railroads and take their property back, but still it would require a massive rebuilding because their trains, they build to an 80-mile-per-hour standard for freight, which is part of the problem why Amtrak is so rickety, because they're not. And that's part of the partnership we could have and I don't think we're going to ever change the ownership of those rail beds, but if we could partner with them to build rails that will accommodate higher speeds, 120 miles an hour, which the Talgo can do, that would be great. And so my target is higher speed rail. I'd love to say, yeah, easy, let's build a national high-speed rail network, but you're going to run into all sorts of problems in terms of takings when you try and do that. They're having that problem even in Texas where they're trying to build a high-speed rail line in Texas because property owners are resistant to being preempted in their property. So it's a very difficult problem.
Bob?
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. Pete, why can't we get Congress to pass a $15 minimum wage with a COLA cost of living increase with it?
Well, I'm a sponsor of a bill to do that, but there is an issue, as I understand it. I mean, first off, the Senate isn't going to even take it up. I mean, that's why we couldn't pass it. But even passing it in the House is difficult because we got into the majority by winning a lot of Trump districts. And a lot of those people, newly elected, are worried about getting reelected. And they want to have a regional minimum wage because they're saying, in my region, in my state, there's like our standard. It's you don't require that much money, but the regional wage would basically create second-class citizens. Oregon did a little of that with its $15 minimum wage, but not very much. And what they're proposing would be way more discriminatory. So I'm supporting the straight up $15. Everybody would play under the same rules. Nobody's disadvantaged. There might be a little inflationary impact. What we would gain in terms of people not having to access food stamps or other things if they had a decent minimum wage would far exceed whatever additional costs we might incur in doing that.
John Dolo, City Club member. Concrete railroad ties. Anyway, railroads. Recently, I heard that the swing bridge on the railroad that you spent a lot of work on getting reopened is not working, and that's one reason why there's the mill in Coos Bay is closing. Is that going to have an effect on this pipeline coming through? I mean, are people going to see all these jobs lost and going to say, well, maybe we should do the pipeline? And also, Eugene used to have a railroad yard. The freight didn't have to go all the way up to Portland and come back down again. Is there any chance of reopening the freight depot in Eugene?
Well, I think the people in the Train Song neighborhood might have some concerns about bringing. I used to live out on River Road, and at 5 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning, you would hear these unbelievable squeals and crashes and all that. So reopening the yard might not be that easy, but it was a private sector decision. I'm concerned about where some of the freight railroads are going. They call it something precision railroading. CSX was the first one to do it. And what they're doing is running it for Wall Street and not for the movement of freight. And that's a huge problem. Burlington Northern is insulated from that, and they're not going to do it because Warren Buffett owns them and they aren't enslaved by Wall Street. Now Union Pacific is looking at it, and I intend to be holding hearings on the issue because we could lose the efficiency of the freight network that UP has out here if they go the same way as CSX, which is driving up stock price short term but losing freight capacity long term and not making the investment you need in terms to have a safer rail system with the rail maintenance or new power, more efficient engines, those sorts of things. That's one part of it. The swing bridge is supposed to be operable on March 23rd. I was down there looking at it just Monday. I was on it. If you look at it, it looks awful. But they assure me, I first went over that bridge 12 or 15 years ago, and then the company that owned the rail line to Coos Bay, which was called Rail America, which bought up all the short lines, proposed to abandon the rail line, tear up the rails, and do away with rail altogether. I worked with then-Governor Kulongoski, and we forced them to sell the line. I got federal money, which was going to go to repair the bridge. We had to use to buy the line, and we got state money, and we bought the line. So we have the capability of moving freight efficiently to Coos Bay that can be put on maritime transport. Or bringing freight into Coos Bay and putting it on rail. So you have the most efficient way of moving it maritime, second most efficient way of moving it rail. And we've avoided a heck of a lot of truckloads. I don't have the number on the top of my head, but by having that rail line. It has been in op. The over 100-year-old bridge needed work, but they claim on March 23rd it will work. And I was told, and I don't know, but GP, I believe, is owned by the Koch brothers. And I'm told that, that wasn't the issue, that there's a lot more timber available now in the southeast. The timber's cheaper and the labor's cheaper. So they're moving more of their operations there, and that was why they were closing that particular mill. I don't know, but it was an increment temporarily on the cost to move the lumber, but it's going away next week. So. That doesn't seem like a reason to close the mill today. I think there may be other forces at work.
Randy.
Rob Zako, City Club member and Executive Director of Better Eugene Springfield Transportation. Congressman DeFazio, thank you for your service and for your leadership on transportation and climate change. Here in Eugene, transportation accounts for half of all of our greenhouse gas emissions, so we've got a huge opportunity to make a difference. As you know, there are three basic ways to reduce our carbon footprint from transportation. We can have more fuel-efficient cars, increase CAFE standards, one. Two, we can have cleaner fuels such as electric vehicles. And three, we can get people driving less and using other modes of transportation like walking, bicycling, and riding the bus. Last week, there was a climate town hall that talked about increasing transit ridership. And this week, the Lane Transit District had a work session where they said the most important thing they could do is increase transit ridership. And so I think this is a good idea. The challenge is that having more transit ridership requires more money to operate the buses. So I'm not going to ask you for the feds to pay for that, but ask for your advice. I think Lane County spends...
Please ask your question, Ron.
What's your advice? Where does the money come from?
Thank you.
Well, as you know, we do have a tax here in Lane County, a minuscule payroll tax, which pays for a lot of LTD's operations. Principally, the federal government is involved in the acquisition of the equipment, and then we expect for the transit system to run. I'm not adverse to allowing some federal funds to go into subsidizing ridership. There's no transit system in the world that makes money. And to tell Amtrak they have to make money is abysmally stupid. And they're pretty close to, in terms of operating, being revenue neutral. And I don't think we should be squeezing them that way. And the same thing with mass transit. I mean, when the plan that came out last session out of the Trump administration was privatization. And I said, how's that going to work for transit? Who's going to, and what private sector firm is going to build transit because you can't make money on it? It just won't work. It has to be a public service. I remember when we had the little green buses here in Eugene. I'm that old. So, we decided that wasn't working for the people and we needed public transportation. So the issues are, how do you get people to the public transportation? Even if we have an EMX route, how do people get there? There's been a massive increase, I mean, unbelievable, in a lot of our urban areas in younger people using scooters and shared bikes and other things like that to get to transit. I visited a system in Florida called Brightline, which is higher speed rail, and it's going currently from Miami to Fort Lauderdale, and it's ultimately going to go to Orlando. And that is a green field, but they've already got the right of way to do that, so they're not having a big issue with that. And what they do is, and I was talking to Lucy about this, is they have an app, and you say, I live at this is my address, this is where I want to go in Miami, and they tell you how much it'll cost, and you click, and you've got it. And an Uber or Lyft picks you up, drops you at the train station. You get on the train, you take the train to Miami, and Uber or Lyft picks you up, and they take you to your destination. Now, that works if you get the money to pay for it, but we have to figure out how do we integrate people who are lower income, students and others into that system. And there are some cities paying subsidies for Lyft and Uber and things like that to get people to the transit. But I was talking to Earl last week, and we had this kind of like, oh my God, wait a minute. If we move to autonomous vehicles and people are using apps like that, the autonomous vehicle companies are going to want to have a whole bunch of autonomous vehicles out there so that you don't wait very long, because then you'll say, well, I'm not going to wait. And so we're talking about ultimately moving to vehicle miles traveled for cars, particularly as we transition to non-fossil fuels. But then Earl and I started thinking about, what are you going to do with zero occupancy vehicles? Like, they're out there cruising around waiting for people, or trying to reposition them. So some of these solutions create new problems that have to be thought through. I'll give one other example. Back in the 90s, Congress said, biofuels, great idea. Well, we ended up with ethanol, which is a huge loser, and I don't know how we'll ever get rid of it, because all the Corn Belt senators are addicted to it, and as long as we have a filibuster in the Senate, we probably can't get rid of it. I voted with Peter Welch, introduced a bill from Vermont to do away with it altogether, but anyway, we haven't gotten too far with that. And So we've got that, and then but there are other biofuels, and there's this potential out there which is extraordinary. There was a guy up in Lebanon who had a short line railroad, and he bought a plant out of Canada that's supposedly been operating and creating from biomass, that is from wood waste, had been creating diesel fuel and char, and the char had applicability in agriculture and other things, and he was going to set that up, and then it got bought by someone from Washington State, and I never heard another word about it. So you sometimes wonder about these things. We did run a very small test of something like that on the Umpqua Forest 2 years ago, and it was successful, and it was mobile, so you could put it in the forest. So after a logging operation, you don't burn the slash, you turn it into usable fuel. And it's a pyrolytic process, so it's self-generating once it gets going. But Congress, in writing the bill, didn't think about what are the perverse effects. And if you saw that, there was a devastating article in the New York Times about a few months ago about what's happened to the tropical forests, because they're mowing them down to plant palm trees. The palm trees create palm oil, which becomes a tax-credited biofuel. So as we make these changes, we have to fully understand, and we probably won't when we make them, But we've got to try and fully think through, well, wait a minute. So just like that moment I had with Earl, which is, yeah, zero occupancy vehicles. Well, maybe we're going to make them pay a much higher vehicle miles traveled because we don't want to create more congestion in trying to get people onto transit and create less congestion. But these are all, you know, this is a sea change in how we move goods and people. We're still living on the Eisenhower plan, which was only the most major modification to our service transportation was done actually by Ronald Reagan, which was when he included transit in the Highway Trust Fund. But we haven't really thought about what does a 21st century system look like, which is what I'm trying to figure out. And since we couldn't talk about it for the last 8 years, we've only begun to hold hearings and talk about it. So there's a lot more to learn.
One quick question and one quick answer.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle Raviolo, and I am a student at the University of Oregon in Environmental Studies, a single mom, and a member of Friends of the Earth Action. Thank you so much for co-sponsoring the Green New Deal. We really need to make sure that fossil fuels are phased out of our industries and go to 100% renewable energies. And I know that you are on board with this 100%. My question today is, will you please sign the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge that states that you will no longer take contributions from the oil, gas, and coal industry, and instead prioritize the health of our families, climate, and democracy over fossil fuel industry profits?
Well, I have already said I will not take money from oil, gas, or coal companies. 350.org classifies trucking companies as fossil fuel companies. I don't agree with that. They're agnostic on what fuel they use. I've never had a trucking company come in and lobby me on drilling off the coasts or in Alaska. What they say is, what are you going to do about the bridges? What are you going to do about the road surface? And so the bottom line is they are not fossil fuel companies, and they would be happy to run electric or hydrogen fuel trucks. So I will take contributions from them. I won't take it from the producers of fossil fuels, and I have stated that. I don't sign pledges, but I state that, and as long as you don't classify a trucking company or a bus company or someone else as fossil fuel, you will see nothing that could be classified as fossil fuel in my on my returns or
thank
my
you.
Whatever my reports.
Thank you.
Now
before we thank our speaker today, Congressman DeFazio, I'd like to advise you that next week we will have two programs. Our monthly event, the Community Spotlight at Tsunami Books, on Wednesday, will feature Lou Whitaker. Some of you remember that Lou joined us earlier this year at the MLK program. We will also have our Friday program, How Should I Vote on the Courthouse Bond Issue, with both sides of that issue. On May 3rd, we have the candidates debate for the 4J school board, and on May 10th, the annual election of officers and board members and the Turtles program. More details about all of these programs at cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's thank Congressman DeFazio for a very exciting program today.